Sooner or later, you can bet your life that every Jew in this building is going to say the same thing. He's a little too Jewish for my coat.
Shalom and welcome to the Two Jewish Radio Show with Rabbi Sam Kohan and friends, a weekly serving of everything Jewish. We'll have a great hour together today of news, music, comedy, and conversation. Our guest this morning is perhaps the premier expert on audience response to Hollywood films. Kevin Getz is the author of the new book, Audienceology: How Moviegoers Shape the Films We Love. We'll also have a visit from our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Please email your comments to us at 2JewishRadio18@gmail.com or visit us on the web at 2JewishRadio.com. The opinions of the host and guests on 2 Jewish are their own and not those of the radio station. 2 Jewish is paid for by 2 Jewish radio programs and podcasts, Tucson, Arizona. And now, here's Rabbi Sam Kohan and 2 Jewish.
Shalom. Some weeks in the Jewish world, there's very little in the way of news to actually report on. But this week is not like that. And two of the many issues confronting the American Jewish world seem particularly worth exploring today. First, one Tennessee school board banned the groundbreaking Pulitzer Prize-winning Holocaust graphic novel Mouse by Art Spiegelman because it included some curse words in the nude depiction of a woman. Actually, it wasn't even a human woman, but a woman depicted as a mouse. But even that was too much for the cretins on this particular Tennessee school board. That ridiculous choice of censorship by one board led to Mouse reappearing on bestseller lists everywhere, of course. If you don't know the book, it came out way back in 1986 and frankly shocked the world with its graphic depiction of Jews as mice, Poles as cats, and Nazis as dogs. It was the first real graphic novel I ever read, and it demonstrated that graphic novels were certainly not the same thing as comic books. Controversial when published 35 years ago, the debate over whether Mouse was respectful in showing the Shoah in that way was vigorous, but it essentially ended with a much greater understanding that Art Spiegelman is a kind of genius with images and words, and that this broadened the knowledge of the Holocaust in profound ways for all kinds of new audiences. Mouse, too, followed and was also impactful. What Art Spiegelman did was great, and his books have been used by many schools and other institutions to try to show just what the Holocaust was and why we need to know about it. If you haven't read the book Mouse, you should. At a time when a distressing percentage of Americans don't know what the Shoah was or the fact that 6 million Jews died in the Holocaust, banning Mouse, which has such a great ability to teach younger people through the medium of a graphic novel, is simply idiotic. Art Spiegelman is not a young man, and he couldn't come on the show today, but he did send me a bookmark he has designed that reads, using the mouse illustration, keep your nose in a book and keep other people's noses out of which book you choose to stick your nose into. Well said. The other important issue that came up this week was a report by Amnesty International claiming that Israel's treatment of Palestinians amounts to systematic apartheid, using language taken directly from the pro-Palestinian organization's anti-Israel playbook. It portrayed Israel as a new version of South Africa. This is the now standard anti-Semitic effort to delegitimize Israel as the only Jewish state in the world. While Jewish organizations in Israel, of course, strongly objected, the U.S. also pushed back officially at the Amnesty International report's characterization of Israel. U.S. State Department spokesperson Ned Price said that the department rejects the view that Israel's actions constitute apartheid. We certainly reject the label that has been attached to this report, Price said. We think it's important as the world's only Jewish state that the Jewish people must not be denied their right to self-determination, and we must ensure there isn't a double standard being applied, which, of course, there is. Amnesty's double standard essentially argues Israel has no right to exist as a Jewish state. Look, Palestinians in the West Bank are under the nominal authority of the Palestinian Authority, while East Jerusalem Palestinians are under a complicated mixed regime, and Israeli Arabs are indeed voting citizens of Israel. there is certainly room to criticize Israel's treatment of Arabs in the West Bank and East Jerusalem, and perhaps even the less than fully equal status of Arab Israelis, not necessarily under the law, but under, you know, the way societies work. But the Amnesty report is a one-sided travesty of libels, slandering Israel as though we're employing pre-Nelson Mandela Afrikaner-style apartheid against every non-Jewish resident of the state and its territories. That is far from the truth. And taking this extreme and totally dishonest approach helps no one, least of all the Arabs in the West Bank and East Jerusalem. The Amnesty report even uses phrases like from the river to the sea, that is, the Jordan to the Mediterranean, a mythical land that Palestinian propaganda promulgates as some sort of future Arab homeland, excluding Israel as a state and Jews as people. At a time when Arab Israelis have their first powerful minister in the Israeli government, and when Arab states like Saudi Arabia, the UAE, Egypt, and Bahrain have all abandoned the Palestinian cause, NGOs like Amnesty International are taking cheap shots at the only actual democracy in the Middle East that guarantees human rights to its citizens, freedom of the press, and operates under the rule of law, that is, Israel. It is, as we say, a shanda, and it needs to be answered. To play us in this morning, here's cantor David Fisher singing Naomi Shemer's classic Israeli song, Al Kol Ela.
Al ha-dvash ve'al ha-okets, al ha-mar ve'ha-matok, al biteinu ha-tinoket, shmorei li ha-tov, al ha-esh ha-mevoeret, על המים חזקים, על האיש השב הביתה מן המרחקים. על כל אלה, על כל אלה, שמונה לי אלי הטוב. על הדבש ועל העוקץ, על המר וה... matok al nata konatua al tishkach et hatikva hashiveni veashuva el haaretz hatova shmorei li al ze habayit על הגן, על החומה, מיגון, מפחד פתע וממלחמה. שמור על המעט שיש לי, על האור ועל התף, על הפרי שלא יבשיל עוד ושנאסף. על כל אלה, על כל אלה, שמונה לי הטוב, על הדבש ועל העוקץ, על המר והמתוק, על נטע כה נטוע, אל תשכח את התקווה, השיבני שובה אל הארץ הטובה.
That was cantor David Dudu Fisher singing Al Kol Ela. Our guest this morning is Kevin Getz, who has helped an incredible array of famous directors, film executives, studio heads, and producers fix their movies using audience testing. He has fabulous stories to share, a new and very entertaining book, Audienceology. Here's some of those stories when we come back in a moment on Too Jewish.
We are the soul of Tucson. We are your neighbors and friends. Our commitment to provide the very best relies on the finest products and services you, our community, has to offer. Together, we make Tucson thrive. When we win, you win. Casino del Sol, the soul of Tucson.
Enterprise of the Pascua-Yaqui Tribe.
We are delighted to welcome to Too Jewish Kevin Getz, who is not a household name, but has had an influence on a whole wide variety of household motion pictures. He's been at the center of the movie research industry in Hollywood for many years. His firm conducts research for a majority of the movies that are released in America and around the world. And he has worked with pretty much all the famous directors and producers and stars, and has some of the best stories you will ever hear. Good morning and welcome to Too Jewish.
Thank you, Rabbi. It's so great to be here.
I should also note that you told me beforehand that you're a Kohen, which means we're family.
I am a Kohen, and I'm proud of it. My father was proud to pass that down to me.
So I'm sure that had a huge influence in how you ended up doing what you call Audienceology, which is the name of your new book, How Moviegoers Shape the Films We Love. Tell us, how does somebody get into this business?
Well, it's so funny. My mother always wanted a Jewish doctor, of course.
Of course, but, like all of our mothers.
But what she got was an actor and then a producer, and then moving into the marketing end of the business. I got the moniker of the doctor of audienceology. Patrick Goldstein of the Los Angeles Times did a piece on me about, I don't know, a dozen years ago. And he dubbed me the doctor of audienceology because I work with audiences in such an intense way. And so it stuck. And that was really, really fun. And it's not far from what I really do, which is watch an unreleased or yet to be released movie with an audience of say 300 or 400 people. Before it comes out, the audience give their sort of unfettered opinions. And I have to come out and give the prognosis to the directors and studio heads, et cetera, on how their film fared with an audience. And then I have to, after that, give a remedy, like your child is not going to make it if you don't do this or that, or you're in really great shape and your child is going to go out and conquer the world. So these are very much the same procedural sort of orders or prescriptives that a doctor goes through.
So somebody shows you a movie or shows a movie. Do you watch it before you show it to an audience?
You know, Rabbi, I don't like to watch a movie before unless it is either extremely complicated or it is, or I'm not going to be able to see the whole thing because I have to, if I'm coming late to the screening because I've got a second screening or something like that. But by and large, I like to be surprised and discover it with the audience. I also don't sit with the executives, which there's a sort of a taped off area for executives in either the back or in the middle of the theater in kind of a block. I like to sit in the aisle where I can watch and look and observe the audience's reaction throughout the movie, because there's a lot of telling news that you can gain from how they are reacting. We call that implicit response. You know, are they leaned forward? Are they gasping? Are they really laughing? Are they guffawing? You know, that kind of thing. And so I spend half my life watching a movie with one eye on the screen and one eye on the audience.
It's a fascinating business. And we'll talk about some of the, well, there's no way we could talk about all the famous people you worked with and all the films you helped fix, but we will talk about a lot of them when we come back with Kevin Getz. His book is called Audienceology, How Moviegoers Shape the Films We Love. It's just a great read, and we'll be back in a moment here on Too Jewish. Congregation Beit Simcha, the House of Joy, a wonderful Jewish synagogue in northwest Tucson in the Catalina foothills, celebrates a great array of services, classes, and events this winter. Established by passionate, caring congregants and me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, Beit Simcha has created a vibrant, vital community that strives every day to serve God with joy. A newish, progressive congregation in northwest Tucson and the foothills, Beit Simcha is open to everyone throughout the entire metropolitan area, providing weekly Shabbat services, youth and adult education academy courses, social justice opportunities, outreach, and cultural Jewish programming. Join us in person for Shabbat services or come on Facebook Live. Go to our website, BeitSimchaTucson.org. We welcome members and guests in our sanctuary only safely, but in person. You can also call 520-276-5675 for more information. Beit Simcha Synagogue is located at 2270 West Ina Road on the north side of Ina, just west of Lachoya, near the entrance to the Foothills Mall property in our own building. Services, classes, and events are open to everyone. Join us in person Friday night and Saturday morning. Come to BeitSimchaTucson.org or email me, rabbi@BeitSimchaTucson.org, or join us every Friday night on our Facebook page. Shabbat evening celebration services are at 6:30 p.m. with full music. Saturday Shabbat morning services are at 10 a.m., all with me leading them at 9 o'clock. On Zoom, you can come to Torah Study, the most interesting one in all of Arizona. Our Facebook page is at Beit Simcha Tucson, BeitSimcha Tucson. Our services and many other events are available there virtually, but you can also, of course, come in person. All of our Adult Education Academy classes are taught live and on Zoom. You can access those through the website, BeitSimchaTucson.org. Our wonderful religious school is available in blended format too, some students live, some on Zoom. For more information about congregation Beit Simcha to attend services, our great religious school and Torah Tikes program, bar and bat mitzvah, confirmation and high school programs, and rich array of Adult Education Academy courses taught in person and on Zoom, and of course all of our services live and on Facebook, go to BeitSimchaTucson.org, BeitSimchaTucson.org, or call 520-276-5675. Also, coming up next Sunday, our Super Bowl Squares party, Rabbi versus Rabbi. I grew up in L.A., my dad in Cincinnati, and boy, the Bengals and Rams are going at it in the Super Bowl. You can join us for a Jewish Super Bowl party with kosher hot dogs at Beit Simcha. Go to our website for more information. Join me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, in the newest Jewish community and the fastest growing synagogue in all of Southern Arizona in its exciting beginning years. Do you know someone who personally made a major difference for the whole Jewish people? An individual who's done important work for Klal Yisrael and deserves to be highly recognized for that effort. As president of the Kohan Memorial Foundation, I'm grateful that the modest cash awards we started more than 10 years ago have grown into a substantial amount of unrestricted funds given to winners, with the help of donors like many of you. The foundation, named for my grandparents, Rabbi Samuel S. Kohan and A. Irma Kohan, makes these awards for important service to Klal Yisrael, the entire Jewish people. That service can be in one of four activities: unity, education, creative arts, or rescue. Past Kohan Award recipients are remarkable people who've done outstanding work. If you know someone who qualifies for a Kohan Foundation Award, please go to kohanaward.com, kohanaward.com, and fill out the simple nomination form. That website is kohanaward.com. Nominate an individual or donate yourself. Do it for the whole Jewish people. If you have a question, comment, compliment, or criticism, kvetch or kvel, please email us at 2JewishRadio18@gmail.com. That's TOOJewishRadio18@gmail. Or visit our website, 2JewishRadio.com. You can hear all past and present shows through the website, streaming us from 2JewishRadio.com, or downloading us from the Apple iTunes Store's very popular Jewish podcasts, Top 10 in America, according to Moment Magazine, and over 175,000 downloads on Podbean. The stories we share last a lifetime and are passed down from generation to generation. Known for our compassionate commitment to the families we serve, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has faithfully served the Tucson community and the Jewish community for over 100 years. We help thousands of families plan and carry out celebrations of loved ones in unique and special ways and assist them in sharing those lifetimes of stories meaningfully. The most beautiful and tranquil final resting place in all of Southern Arizona, Evergreen's tall pines shade peaceful grassy fields. You can count on Evergreen for superior service and the highest degree of integrity. Our informative, well-trained staff is here to assist you with a full range of on-site services. Call Evergreen, 520-888-7470, 520-888-7470. While we serve the whole community, our experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox, is second to none. We have sections dedicated to all religious faiths, can help you arrange for your future needs or your immediate ones. Whether you choose to hold a traditional funeral service or a completely individualized ceremony, either in person or online or both, our goal is to help you create a meaningful, personalized service based upon your unique needs in a place of reflection, tradition, and serenity. Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best to the community and to you. Call 520-888-7470. To speak to a family advisor at Evergreen, call 520-888-7470. We welcome our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Rabbi.
Numbers matter. I know people, individuals matter more than numbers, but when we go around and try to count the Jews, it's a very difficult proposition, complicated enough in a place like America where Jewish identity is not always obvious, but it's really complicated in places like the former Soviet Union or even Western Europe, where it's really difficult to know who's Jewish, especially if they're not so sure they're Jewish or they don't want to come forward with their Judaism. Let's talk about it a little bit.
It's a very good topic. Let's start with the community that's most familiar to most of your listeners, which is the Jewish community in the United States. And even there, or I should say even here.
Here,
right?
Yes. Pretty sure we're in America right. Here. So most days it feels like America.
Even here, nobody agrees on the definition of who is a Jew. Different movements of Judaism, different streams of Jewish thought have different definitions.
Heck, in Israel, Mihu HaYehudi is still a big topic. So.
Right. Well, it certainly is here too. So
for sure.
Part of the problem of counting is how you define who is a Jew. So if somebody needs to have two Jewish parents to be a Jew, you come out with a very different number than you do if they only need to have one Jewish parent. And if they need to have a Jewish mother specifically, you come out with a very different number from what you come out with if you say they need to have a Jewish parent. So already in our country, this is a very complicated question. And it's also a question of who chooses to identify as a Jew to sign up for any Jewish newsletter or email, or let alone affiliate with the congregation, which numbers are at a historic low, but I certainly wouldn't say that Jewish life in this country is at a historic low. So there's just a growing discrepancy between the number of Jews in America who belong to synagogues or temples or whatever.
Give to federations, whatever it is, right?
And the numbers altogether. So that's in the country that's most familiar to us. Now let's go to a country that's much less familiar to us, like Ukraine or the former Yugoslavia or the Russian Federation. These are places where people's safety and security often depended on hiding any aspect of their Jewish identity. So not only did they not rush to affiliate with congregations or federations or registered Jewish communities, but they actively hid their Jewish ancestry and their Jewish background. So there, all the official counts, I think, are grotesque understatements. You'll get a figure like 200 Jews in a place where there's really 2,000. And that's a result of their history. So I want to come back maybe next week to the specific question of the former Soviet Union, because I said recently on one of the broadcasts that the third biggest Jewish community in the world after the U.S. and Israel was France. And that's certainly true in terms of the number of people who are formally registered or formally affiliated. But whether it's ultimately true in terms of who has a Yiddish neshama,
yeah,
or a Jewish grandparents, or in some cases a growing Jewish identity, even if they're not formally affiliated,
right?
That could be a number of other candidate countries.
We can talk about them next week. Thanks so much, Tom. We'll talk then.
I look forward to it.
It's time now for our old Jewish joke of the week. Jewish humor, your Bubby and Zadie knew, brought to you by Too Jewish as a public service. A buddy of mine is a huge Rams fan, and he has two Super Bowl seats on the 40-yard line at SoFi Stadium. He paid $10,000 each, but he didn't realize when he bought them it would turn out to be the exact same day as his wedding, probably because of the extra regular season game this year and the later date for the Super Bowl. Anyway, if you're interested, he's looking for somebody to take his place. It's at Temple Valley Beth Shalom at 3 p.m. The bride's name is Sarah. She's 5 feet 4 inches, weighs 110 pounds, and she's a very good cook. She'll be in the white dress under the chuppah. That was the old Jewish joke of the week, special feature of Too Jewish, just for you should live and be well all the way through Super Bowl Sunday next week. And now a word of Torah. This week we read the portion of Titzaveh in Exodus, giving the commandment to create a Ner Tamid, an eternal light for the tabernacle in the wilderness. That tabernacle was the first sanctuary of our people Israel, the place where God's presence in the form of the Shekhinah resided. Last week in Truma, our ancestors were asked to create this sacred space through the voluntary gifts of their hearts. This week, we're told that there should be a constant fire, a ner tamid, a continual light shining on the altar, sign of God's faithful and permanent presence in our midst. Revealingly, that light is to be created and kindled by us, not God. We must build the altar and the fire and continue to feed and nurture it to keep it alive. If you've ever kept a fire burning round the clock, you know just how much fuel you need. You're always either stoking it or bringing in more wood to burn. If neglected for any length of time, that fire burns out. The Ner Tamid was not just a symbol, but a process, requiring regular care and feeding to flourish. Our spiritual life is like that ancient Ner Tamid. If we wish God's presence to illuminate our lives, to give us warmth and comfort, we too must feed our own Ner Tamid, regularly adding spiritual fuel to the flame. Religious experiences, prayer, meditation, introspection, blessings, personal and communal rituals, time for breathing and allowing God into our lives, all of these feed the fire. And they must be done with regularity, or our own internal, eternal lights will go out. The Ner Tamid, that ancient light, is found today in every synagogue in the world, no matter how humble the shul or how grand the temple. But its symbolic purpose is much greater. The Ner Tamid burns always to remind us that God is with us always. If we only take the time to feed our own spiritual fires regularly. When we come back on Too Jewish, our guest, Kevin Getz, shares fabulous stories about saving famous films and just how audiences help make Hollywood movies into blockbusters. Find out all about it when we come back in a moment here on Too Jewish.
We continue with our Too Jewish update on news of Jews around the world with commentary.
The historic New York City synagogue that controls the even more historic Touro Synagogue in Newport, Rhode Island, moved to terminate the lease of the congregation that prays there. That provoked cries from the congregation that's been holding services at the Touro for over a century that it's being evicted. Don't call it eviction, the leaders of Congregation Sheirit Israel in New York say. They describe the legal filing as an effort to restructure the board of Congregation Yeshuat Israel, which has met at the Touro for 120 years, and install a new slate of officers who will ensure Touro Synagogue is properly maintained into the future. Sheirit Israel says the current rabbi and congregants are encouraged and welcome to remain. Meanwhile, leaders of Yeshuat Israel call it a power grab. Last week's filing with the State District Court Second Division in Rhode Island is the latest twist in a tense and litigious relationship between Sheirit Israel, North America's oldest Jewish congregation, and Yeshuat Israel, which has leased the Touro, a National Historic Site, since the early 20th century. Founded by Sephardic Jews in the 18th century, the Touro is best known for a visit by President George Washington and a letter he wrote to the congregation promising the Jews religious liberty. It is a particularly beautiful little shul. I had the privilege of participating in services there some years back. Sherith Israel, also known as the Spanish and Portuguese Synagogue in New York, has had a close relationship with Touro from its beginning, when Touro's founders included Sephardic grandees who had belonged to Sherith Israel. The Manhattan Synagogue has owned the Touro since the 1820s. The original Sephardic congregation in Newport, Rhode Island eventually dwindled, and Sherith Israel leased the building to Yeshuat Israel, an Ashkenazic congregation of 125 families. The two Orthodox congregations clashed publicly over the past decade when Yeshuat Israel tried to sell an incredibly valuable set of 18th century Torah Rimonim, crowns from Touro's inventory, for $6 million. In 2019, the New York Synagogue's ownership of the building and its artifacts was legally confirmed when the U.S. Supreme Court declined to take up Yeshuat Israel's claim that it was the rightful steward. Sherith Israel's move to reshape Yeshuat Israel's board was precipitated by two disputes in the summer of 2021. The New York Synagogue's leaders complained after learning that Yeshuat Israel allowed the erection of a new gravestone in Newport's historic Jewish cemetery, which Touro operates. That gravestone is reserved for Ambassador John Loeb, an investment counselor and philanthropist for whom the synagogue's visitor's center is named. Loeb is still alive. Sherith Israel's leaders said the gravestone would never have been permitted by Sherith Israel without research into important issues of Jewish law and aesthetics. The New York Synagogue and the Newport congregation clashed also when Yeshuat Israel claimed they would need to raise between $2 million and $5 million for repairs to the Georgian-style Touro building. According to Lewis Solomon, Sherith Israel's Parnas, or president, Sherith Israel said they had been told the Touro building was not in need of any significant repairs. It's about transparency. It's about trust, decision-making. It's not about money, said Solomon. They've never raised funds. The Touro Synagogue Foundation and Sherith Israel's congregants are the ones who've given the big money. In a statement to congregants on January 22nd, the leadership of the Newport congregation said, "We are shocked that Sherith Israel seeks to expel Rhode Island's congregation Yeshuat Israel from the historic Touro Synagogue, oldest synagogue in the country and the nation's cradle of religious liberty. The members of Yeshuat Israel congregation have been faithful stewards of and peaceable worshipers at Touro Synagogue for more than 140 years. At a time of unprecedented attacks on American Jewry, we are devastated. Our congregation has become the target of a shameful power grab by another Jewish congregation that over the years has not provided us or the Touro any meaningful support. We condemn this destructive attack on our congregation and displacement of our community. Call upon Sherith Israel to let Yeshuat Israel live and pray in peace." Solomon says the 450-member New York Synagogue, that's Sherith Israel, got to keep him straight, is only seeking what's best for the future of the Touro and in its rights as the owner. The new board, he said, are going to be people willing to talk to us and not slam the phone down and hide from us. There's going to be transparency. Under the restructuring, current religious services will not change. The rabbi and congregation will be allowed to continue to hold services in the building. Sherith Israel says it would claim two seats on a reconstituted board. The others, said Solomon, go to philanthropists, current board members, local academics, and other passionate stakeholders. The Yeshuat Israel congregation objects to the call for board members from the New York Synagogue without any promise of a long-term lease. Granting this demand of two board seats will not provide any long-term stability or comfort with respect to our congregation's future ability to pray at the Touro Synagogue. Ultimately, Yeshuat Israel says their independence has been earned over many years of tenancy at Touro. We may own the building in trust, but we are a proud congregation with a proud history. Our independence is vital to our future. In other words, no landlord participates in its tenants' activities on a day-to-day basis like this. Solomon said restructuring will allow Sherith Israel to go ahead with plans to expand Touro as a pilgrimage and educational site serving Jews around the country and the world. Sherith Israel's rabbi, Dr. Meir Soloveitchik, has a keen interest in American colonial history. There's no reason why the Touro should not be an important center of the Jewish historical world in America. Mm-hmm. In other unpleasant news, Whoopi Goldberg has been suspended from a talk show, The View, after saying the Holocaust involved two groups of white people. ABC News says Goldberg will be off air for 2 weeks after her wrong and hurtful comments. The actress and TV personality said on ABC's popular The View that the Nazi genocide of the Jews was not about race. She apologized, but then caused further offense while attempting to explain her remarks on Stephen Colbert's late-night show. In a note to staff last week, ABC News President Kim Godwin wrote, "Effective immediately, I'm suspending Whoopi Goldberg for 2 weeks for her wrong and hurtful comments. While Whoopi has apologized, I've asked her to take time to reflect and learn about the impact of her comments. The entire ABC News organization stands in solidarity with our Jewish colleagues, friends, family, and communities." Just last week, I noted that the culture at ABC News is one that is driven, kind, inclusive, respectful, and transparent. Whoopi's comments do not align with those values. This was Goldberg's, I don't know, a third or fourth apology for her comments. "Yesterday on the show, I misspoke," she said to start The View. "The Holocaust is indeed about race because Hitler and the Nazis consider the Jews to be an inferior race. Now words matter, mine are no exception. I regret my comments. I stand corrected. I also stand with the Jewish people." The 66-year-old Oscar-winning actress, who's been on The View since 2007, first made the controversial comments on the show while discussing the Tennessee school board's banning of Mouse, Art Spiegelman's graphic novel about the Holocaust, on the grounds it showed nudity, profanity, and suicide. Amid the uproar, she released an apology a few hours later, but then on the Colbert show, while attempting to clarify her comments, Whoopi Goldberg said the Nazis had lied. They had issues with ethnicity, not race, which caused further offense. Deborah Lipstadt, whose confirmation as State Department anti-Semitism monitor has been delayed because of past criticism of Republicans, has finally secured a confirmation hearing date next week. The Emory University Holocaust historian and past guest of Two Jewish will get her hearing February 8th, a spokesman for the Senate Foreign Relations Committee said. Republican Senator James Risch, minority leader on the committee, put a stop on advancing President Joe Biden's nomination of Deborah Lipstadt because of her past criticism of Republicans. Jewish groups then mounted an offensive, arguing that filling the role was more important than ever in the wake of the recent attack on the synagogue in Colleyville, Texas. The most recent appeal came from 100 Jewish federations and Jewish community relations councils nationwide. Once the committee approves Lipstadt's nomination, it goes to the full Senate, where Democrats in the majority will surely confirm her. The anti-Semitism monitor is responsible for reporting on anti-Semitism overseas and pressing governments to adopt measures to mitigate anti-Semitism. And finally, Florida Governor Republican Ron DeSantis refused to condemn a Nazi rally in Orlando last weekend, claiming that those asking him to condemn the Nazi rally are trying to smear him. A video of the Orlando rally on social media showed protesters standing on a highway overpass in front of banners of swastikas. The group shouted anti-Semitic slurs, and an array of bipartisan Florida politicians, including Republican Senator Rick Scott, Democratic Congresswoman Val Demings, condemned the gathering. But DeSantis claimed those asking him to condemn the Nazis tried to use this as some type of political issue, were not playing their game. Apparently, DeSantis would rather play the neo-Nazi game. Among those calling on DeSantis to condemn the Nazi rally was the ADL's Florida office. "We expect any public official, especially Governor Ron DeSantis, to address the fears of the Jewish community thoughtfully, not with this troubling and careless approach," said the Florida ADL. Nikki Fried, Florida's Jewish Agriculture Commissioner, running for governor as a Democrat, said she was horrified but not surprised at DeSantis' lack of condemnation of neo-Nazis. The ADL and others' calls for DeSantis to speak out against the rally came after the governor's spokesperson, Christina Pushaw, asked whether the rallies might have simply been in disguise. "Do we even know they're Nazis? I trust Florida law enforcement to investigate and am awaiting their conclusion," she said in a tweet she later deleted. The Orlando rally was one of several anti-Semitic incidents last weekend across North America, weeks after the hostage attack in Texas. A Jewish school and synagogue in Chicago were vandalized, and swastikas were painted on a train station in Washington, D.C. In Canada, a rally in Ottawa against COVID-19 vaccine mandates also featured swastikas. And that's the Two Jewish News of Jews around the world. We welcome back to Two Jewish. Our guest this morning, Kevin Getz, is the author of Audienceology, How Moviegoers Shape the Films We Love. He has had a hand in the shaping and, I guess, fixing of more films than probably any director, producer, or editor in current film, maybe ever. Tell me a story about one film that needed a lot of work and turned out really well.
Oh, boy. Well, there's a lot of examples. I mean, I've worked on, in my 35-year career, I've worked on, I just passed my 7,000th title.
Oh, my gosh.
And that is means I've attended probably close to 30,000 screenings. So, yeah, so it's really hard because most every movie has some kind of change associated with it. Some much greater than others. Let me give you an example of something that was really a big change, that a movie that was several years ago called Fatal Attraction with Glenn Close and Michael Douglas.
Yeah.
It's kind of a seminal example of using research to create great change in the the confines of a movie. So what happened was we tested the movie, and it was, and I'm spoiler alert, if anyone hasn't seen it and still is going to see it, they should probably drop off and come in another minute.
Well, that movie's been out for a long time. If they haven't seen it yet, you can talk about it safely.
Okay, so that movie played really well with the audience when we first screened it, but about the last 5 minutes, you could literally feel the air going out of the room. And the reason is Glenn Close is obsessed with Michael Douglas. Ann Archer is the wife of Michael Douglas. Michael Douglas had an affair with Glenn Close, who is obsessed with him, and he doesn't want anything to do with her anymore. It was a one night stand for him, and for her, it was the love of her life. So at the end, after tormenting him, really, she commits suicide. She takes her life by suicide. With a knife. And while I think Madame Butterfly played in the background, an opera, and she kind of writhed down the wall or something, if I recall. Now, the audiences felt, okay, she's dead, so she's not going to bother him anymore. But they were completely unsatisfied because she didn't get comeuppance. He, Michael Douglas, who had felt, okay, I screwed up. My wife's going to give me another chance. You felt there was enough remorse where people forgave him, right? And Ann Archer didn't get any comeuppance. And Glenn Close didn't get what was coming to her, the character Alex, because she was so horrible to him. So the audience in the focus group after, everyone fills out a questionnaire, and then we assemble 20 people to participate in a discussion after everyone leaves the theater. Some people stay behind. And literally when I asked what was the reason if you gave it a very good, which more people gave it a very good than an excellent. We asked the first question, all important, how did you rate it overall, the movie? And it was either the choices are excellent, very good, good, fair, poor. Well, most people came in at a very good or a good because the movie was good. It just wasn't satisfying. So as if they rehearsed it, they all said the ending. It rang clear as a bell in the room, but no one was convinced. So we took it to, I think, Seattle, maybe started in LA, then Seattle, then Atlanta. I think it went to 3 or 4 places, and as if rehearsed again, everyone said the ending, the ending, the ending. So what to do? Everyone assembled in Sherry Lansing's office back at the studio. She was head of the studio, and she said, we've got to do something, and we think we need to reshoot an ending, and we have to give an emotional satisfaction. We got the intellectual satisfaction, meaning it made sense, but it didn't feel good. So they crafted, a new ending that was not embraced by the director, Adrian Lyne, nor the star, Glenn Close. They had to be very much convinced to get on board with even shooting a new ending. Once they got them on board, Michael Douglas was a producer, and he was on board from the beginning. and Ann Archer was fine with it. So once they reshot, they crafted an ending where Glenn Close's character Alex shows up at Michael Douglas's house, his private space. And, well, we know that she was there because, of course, if you remember the famous scene where she boils the rabbit.
Yeah, the rabbit. I will never forget the rabbit.
Yeah, the all-famous rabbit. So the way that they crafted the reshoot was that we are now going to have Glenn Close hiding in the bathroom while Michael Douglas, I believe, is shaving or something, and she comes out of the shower curtain and with a knife and, you know, wields it at Michael Douglas. He defends himself. They struggle. He grabs her and says, like, enough. And he strangles her in the water of the bathtub. That's right. It was not a shower. It was a bathtub. And she drowns. So we think. And then the fake ending, of course, is that Glenn Close is dead. Michael Douglas is recovering at the sink, breathing. Glenn Close comes out of the water with the knife and goes to stab him. Just before she stabs him, in the doorway is Ann Archer. Boom, boom, boom with the gun, shoots Glenn Close dead. And we tested it again. And Rabbi, if I told you that the audience rose out of their seats, the scores came up 30 points. Now, that doesn't necessarily mean anything to people listening, but I can tell you that the difference was a movie that would have grossed 50, 60, 70 million dollars, grossed hundreds of millions of dollars worldwide, and became a cultural phenomenon. Cover of Time magazine, et cetera, and entered the zeitgeist as a classic movie as a result of that. Isn't that fun?
It wasn't fun for the Glenn Close character, but it's a great story about how to turn a movie from, might have been okay, to huge. I mean, it had a huge cultural impact, I remember.
Huge, yeah. And it would have been a fine movie, a very good movie.
Yeah, and instead it became
a great movie.
Yeah, that's right.
Here's why it hit on both cylinders of intellectually satisfying, all the questions answered, and emotionally satisfying. And when you get that marriage of those two, and it doesn't have to be a happy ending, clearly.
No, obviously.
Just a satisfying ending, because as you know, human nature is, you want revenge on the person who's wronged you.
On the bad guy, or the bad woman in this case.
Probably against Jewish law, but
well, you know, and I think actually it was very important that it be Ann Archer that did that, not Michael Douglas, in that. You know, it was very clever to have turned that ending in that way.
That's very smart of you to observe that, because it would have been like the male who wronged, you know, takes the revenge. But in fact, they killed, you know, quite literally, or no pun or pun intended, they quite literally killed two birds with one stone, right?
Yeah,
because
that's right.
They got comeuppance for all of them. Michael Douglas ended it. It was finally done. Glenn Close got what she deserved, and Ann Archer, the wronged wife, got what she really wanted.
So,
you know.
So I want to talk about. First of all, you quote William Goldman saying, "In Hollywood, nobody knows anything about anything." Basically, right? Or nobody knows anything.
That's a famous quote. Right. That nobody knows anything. When I met with Bill, Bill was doing a new book, and he asked to interview me for it. So I met him at his apartment, which was, I think, a penthouse or something. Because I remember the elevator opened and he greeted me into his apartment. It was one of those that had the whole floor. And I remember holding his two Oscars, Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid, I believe, and all the President's Men. I believe those were his two Oscars. One was a little heavier than the other. I remember that, by the way. Anyway, we sat there in his apartment, and, you know, I said, your quote, it could not be more accurate, you know, and I was acknowledging that. But he said, you know, some version of, well, nobody knows anything, but why you intrigue me and why I want to talk to you is you know a little bit more because you have data. And I loved that because it is what I always say to people. It's like, I'm not some soothsayer. I have a very fine-tuned barometer, I think, and I feel very blessed to have worked on so many great movies and many not-so-great movies to sort of hone that that barometer of what works and what doesn't in audiences' minds. But he was saying, though, that the wisdom of the crowds. I mean, maybe one person doesn't know anything, but I'll tell you something. When a person honks at you on the freeway, they're a jerk, right? When four people honk at you on the freeway, you're the jerk. And so you have to look at yourself in a mirror sometimes, and you have to reflect on what is the audience telling me? Because what I set out as a filmmaker to communicate in that movie may not in fact be what I communicated or thought I did. How many movies do your listeners or have your listeners seen in the last couple of years that were just so long? You're like, oh my gosh, really? Or the endings were just weird and you just took me on a journey for 2 hours and that's how you ended it?
Right.
What we try to do is to mitigate that and to say most people, they don't need it whether he did it or didn't kill that person, but it could be an ambiguous ending, but you still have to give me more. And that's what we communicate. So it's just information, but it's information not just by one, but by many.
By the way, this is just kind of the tip of the iceberg. So many great stories. Kevin, where can people go to find out more about Audienceology, more about you, and learn more?
Well, they could go to my website at kevingetz360.com, and that's Getz is G-O-E-T-Z. So kevingetz360.com. And then there's like a trailer for the book. It kind of tells you what the book's about. And you can also get linked to order it. Of course, they can go to Amazon or wherever books are sold. Simon & Schuster is the author, and they've already given me a second book, which I'm thrilled about, called How to Score in Hollywood. Yeah. And that's about getting to the green light process. So it's exciting. So I do hope they'll buy the book or they'll get the audio version. I think it's a lot of fun. And I so appreciate you having me on your show. Please wish me
mazel and bracha, as we say. Kevin, this
we
is a great
say
pleasure.
Mazel and bracha, yeah.
Thanks so much. And mazel tov on completing this book. It only took 13 years. It's like a bar mitzvah.
You know what? 13 years and 18 minutes of this interview. It's meant to be.
Perfect. When we come back on Too Jewish, we'll hear about next week's guest and get a final musical play out.
We are the soul of Tucson. We are your neighbors and friends. Our commitment to provide the very best relies on the finest products and services you, our community, has to offer. Together, we make Tucson thrive. When we win, you win. Casino del Sol, the soul of Tucson.
Enterprise of the Pasquayaki Tribe.
Thanks for being here with us this morning on Too Jewish with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan. Join us next week. Our guest will be Mayor Kate Gallego of Phoenix. And don't forget, join us at Congregation Beit Simcha in person every Friday night for services in Oneg Shabbat, starting at 6:30 p.m. Saturday morning to 9 a.m. Torah study, 10 a.m. services, Torah reading and Kiddush, all live in person and available online. Go to BeitSimchaTucson.org for more information and for our Super Bowl Squares party. Play out this morning on Too Jewish comes from Simply Tzfat, their version of a Lecha Dodi medley. My friends, have a healthy week. God willing, a Shavua Tov, a good week, and a week we pray of peace. Yeah.
sponsored by two Jewish radio programs, Tucson, Arizona.